This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2019, held at Faith Builders from July 29 through August 2.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
I am Carol Burkholder, and I have been teaching for, I finished 34. I'm planning to go back this year, so 35. Not sure how much longer, but for now, that's where I am. So, how many of you teach Pilgrim's Progress?
A couple of them.
I haven't. I want to do it this year.
To do it this year?
Yeah.
Okay. Same thing. And you've been teaching it?
Well, I haven't. 1 year.
Okay. What level do you teach it on?
High school
level. Okay, that's what I do. They had asked me to try to gear it toward junior high, but I've never actually done that myself. I've never taught junior high. I've always taught high school, and so the things that I've done have been on the high school level. And so I wanted to get a little bit of a feel of where you are, what level you are on. I teach it as part of the British literature class that runs every other year, and it's juniors and seniors who take it. Typically, juniors and seniors who take it. So, those are the things that the classes that I've used and the level that I've used it on. So, my plan for the workshop is to look at a couple of reasons why do we teach Pilgrim's Progress? What is the value of teaching that? And then some methods to use in teaching it, some things that I've tried, some things I'd like to try, just some ideas of things, and if you've taught it, some things that you've maybe done, some things like that. And then just discussing some things that we could try, some things that we could do, and maybe some other reasons that I don't have for teaching it. Because I think there are quite a few good reasons to use Pilgrim's Progress. The first one that I'd like to look at is the literary value of Pilgrim's Progress. So, what is the value of teaching Pilgrim's Progress? And of course, as a literature teacher, I want to look at what's the literary value of teaching Pilgrim's Progress? It is, number one, it is a classic piece of literature. So what is a classic? What's the definition of a classic? The definition for a classic is that it expresses artistic quality, stands the test of time, has a certain universal appeal, makes connections to other works of significance, and has relevance to multiple generations. Okay, so there are different elements, different parts that make something a classic. Artistic quality, it has to be good writing. Number one, stands the test of time. Some of my students, they need to read a classic for one of their book reviews. They must read a classic, and they'll bring this book that was published in 2017 that says at the top, a classic. And I'm like, that writer hopes that's a classic. The writer hopes that it lasts, and the publisher probably hopes that it lasts for a long time. But if it's only been published couple of years ago, there's no way it's a classic. Not yet. If it's still around 50 years from now, then it might be a classic, but it's not a classic. They're just hoping that it becomes that. And you'll see books like that published, and at the top or somewhere on it, it'll say a classic. They're hoping so. Universal appeal. Something that will appeal to people over in different cultures, different time periods, different groups of people. There's some sort of a universal appeal. And to have a universal appeal, it has to deal with some of the universal questions of life, if it's going to have some universal appeal. Connections to other works of significance. Most classics will make some connection to things in history, to things in the Bible, to other pieces of literature that are known to be classics and known to have significance. There'll be references to other writers and significant writers, and has relevance to multiple generations. If it doesn't have relevance to people today as it did three generations ago, there's no relevance. It's not going to last. It's not going to last. So Pilgrim's Progress has been a classic. I read somewhere that it's been a classic for over 300 years. It's been around for a long time. It has been around for a long time. Wikipedia says, and I don't really trust Wikipedia too much for academia, but because anybody can post on Wikipedia, but Wikipedia does say that it is regarded as one of the most significant works of religious English literature and has been translated into more than 200 languages and has never been out of print. Sound like a classic? Something that's been around for a long time. Generations. Never been out of print. Has relevance. People are still reading it because there are things in it that are still relevant today. So it is a classic. Second reason for using Pilgrim's Progress is that it is an allegory. An allegory is a very common literary form. It's a good form for students to become familiar with and to recognize what it is. We see it in medieval drama with the medieval play Everyman. We see it in the 17th century with Pilgrim's Progress. We see it again in the 20th century with Animal Farm by George Orwell. Those are all allegories. Chronicles of Narnia, in many ways, is allegorical. Jan Martel, the author of The Life of Pi, P-I, says, allegorical fiction can take very complex realities and convey them in a powerful, emotional, psychologically accurate way. And so it's taking something that's very complex and putting it into a story, into a form that we can understand. And it's generally hard to miss the point of an allegorical writing. Characters, places, names of people are usually exactly what they are. Names of places, often directly related to what they represent. Jesus used a form of allegory in all the parables that he used. The parable is a form of an allegory. So we have allegories used, and I think it's important for students to recognize the form of an allegory. Aesop's fables are forms of allegories. Allegory is a genre that's been around for centuries and just useful in teaching complex things in simple language. And with fables, it's usually animals, and we can look at the animal that's doing this ridiculous thing and laugh about it, and suddenly you realize, that's people. I might act like that too. And so it gets a point across that in a little, it kind of eases the pain of the lesson sometimes. So I think our students should be familiar with allegory. And with Pilgrim's Progress, the entire book is an allegory. And within that book, there are places that are allegorical within the larger allegory. Remember the interpreter's house. Get to the interpreter's house, and we have the interpreter. Well, Christian goes into the interpreter's house, and he asks the question, "What does this mean? What meaneth this?" And then the interpreter starts to explain the parlor is the heart of the man that was never sanctified by the sweet grace of the gospel. The dust is his original sin, and he shows the allegory of the interpreter's house, the dusty parlor, and everything that is represented by everything that's in there. And the interpreter is explaining that to him. And so within the larger context of Pilgrim's Progress being an allegory, we have those little allegorical things all the way along the way that help to explain it. And he goes on with talking about the work of grace in the heart and all that. We go to the Giant Despair's castle and the dungeon that they're in, and at the end, Christian discovers that he has this key in his pocket, and the key is promise, and he remembers it. Anybody remember what day of the week he remembers that key is in his pocket? He's suddenly reminded of this key that's in his pocket. Oh, I have a key called promise. It was on a Sunday. And he takes the key and he opens the gates and they can get out of the castle. And the sun is shining out there. And when the giant Despair gets out into the sunshine, he's incapacitated. He dies. Well, he dies, but he loses his strength. Because despair cannot exist in the sunshine. And I think it's significant that Christian is reminded of his key on a Sunday. Just like we might be reminded of God's promises while we're sitting in the church service. Those are all, I think, allegorical things that are significant as you go through the story. Third one is, from a literary standpoint, is that it is a good example of 17th century British literature. It's clearly from the Puritan age. The language that is used, and if you're going to teach it on a lower level, on a middle school level, junior high level, the language of the original might be a little bit difficult. Just the structure, the words that are used might be a little bit difficult for them. A high school level, they can get it. They might say, I can't read this, this is old English. No, it's not. This is actually classified as modern English. It's just a little bit older dialect. But I always tell my students, they are at an advantage over most students, most high school students in the United States. Because they are familiar all their lives, they've heard the King James, which is the same time period. And most students have never been familiar with that language. And so our students are usually having an advantage in dealing with 17th century English. Church situations are, from a history perspective of Pilgrim's Progress, one of the things that Christian says is about, he says, I espied a little before me a cave where two giants, Pope and Pagan, dwelt in old time. But whose power and tyranny the men whose bones, blood, ashes, etc., lay there were cruelly put to death. But by this place Christian went without danger, whereat I somewhat wandered. But I have learned since that Pagan has been dead many a day. So all the pagan religions have been dead, and England was no longer a pagan country. Christianity had come to England. And so it was no longer pagan. So the pagan giant was dead for many days. And as for the other, though he be yet alive, he is by reason of age also of the many shrewd brushes that he met with in his younger days, grown so crazy and stiff in his old joints that he can now do little more than sit in his cave's mouth, grinning at pilgrims as they go by, and biting his nails because he could not come at them. And that's Pope. The Catholic Church in England was not very strong at that time. And so he has these two giants, Pagan and Pope. And so looking at it with the history in it, what's happening in the churches? It's showing the time period. I always say that literature reflects the society. And that's one of the things in society, that in the British society at the time, that becomes evident in here. Brendan shows us the condition, what's happening in the churches. And the last one, and probably the least important of all of these, is that it is an example of dream literature, which is an interesting concept. Interesting, sometimes called dream allegory, sometimes called dream vision. But it's an allegorical tale presented in the narrative framework of a dream. So the Pilgrim's Progress starts out with, "As I walked through the wilderness of this world, I lighted upon a place where was a den and laid me down in that place to sleep. And as I slept, I dreamed a dream." And all the rest of the book is that dream. All the rest of the book is that dream. Until at the very end, the very last sentence of part one, "And so I awoke, and behold, it was a dream." You can't take, as a writer, you can't put people into dream and take them all the way through the dream and not wake up. It has to be within the framework of the dream. So you start out with the introduction of the dream, you give the whole dream, and then right at the end, I woke up. And dream literature is a fascinating concept of that framework that's used. And there are other examples of that, of dream literature. Roman de la Rose, first part of it, is an allegory that from the 13th century that is dream literature. Chaucer's book of the Duchess, The Pearl, Piers Plowman, all of those, there's at least a part of it that is a dream. And it's an interesting form. So those are the things that I have for the literary value of A Pilgrim's Progress, and I think it is worth doing on a literary basis as a part of a literature course. Second one that I want to look at is the spiritual value of A Pilgrim's Progress. And what I have is not by any means complete, because I don't know how you would do looking at everything that's in here. There's no way it would be possible in an hour to look at everything that's in here that is of spiritual value. If you start looking at the biblical references that are in here, it's just all the way through it. All the way through. So I've picked out a couple of aspects, and a couple of examples of things that I think make it worthwhile. And you may be thinking of something else that you think is important and I didn't include it. That's not because, it's just because I didn't think of it when I was doing this. There's a lot of things in there. First one that I want to mention is God's faithfulness. It's shown throughout the book, both parts one and part two. How many of you read part two? Okay. Part two is Christian's wife and children following him later. And I don't teach part two, but if you're teaching Pilgrim's Progress, you probably should read part two at some point. Because there are, it just brings kind of a completion to the whole thing a little bit more if you read part two. But I don't actually teach part two. I always teach part one. But part two is the one. I mean, part one is the one that is most familiar. Only in part two do we learn what becomes of Christian's wife and his children. The four boys. We learn that Christian follows her husband. She says, and I didn't write down where it is, and I'm not sure exactly where it was. She says of her departed husband, "His lord and ours did gather up his tears and put them in his bottle, and now both I and thou and these sweet babes are reaping the fruit and benefit of them." And so she recognizes that she's reaping the benefits of what Christian has experienced, and the faithfulness of God to him, and she's reaping some of their benefits. There are instances that show Christian's leadership, although they don't go with him. They follow him later, but they show some of his leadership, such as the sign that he posts at Bypass Meadows that warns them not to go through it. Okay? And so he's giving some direction, and it's, I think, a part of God's faithfulness in his putting the sign there for them, for anyone who follows. He doesn't particularly put it there for his wife and children. He puts it there so that anyone coming after him will see it and not make the mistakes that he did. Not make the same mistake. As she sees it, knows that that Christian had put it there. I think that Pilgrim's Progress also teaches us something about living godly lives. For example, what does a godly man do when he gets weary? What does a godly conversation look like? And you have numerous conversations that Christian holds with others, both Christian and non-Christian. He and Faithful have long conversations between themselves. Both of them, faithful Christians. But then he also has conversations with hypocrisy and talkative and ignorance, and points out the fallacy in what they're believing as they hold the conversation. How does a Christian handle discontent or a difficult path, a difficult journey? How are we to think about the preaching of the word? Christian talks about some of those things. How can a Christian recognize backsliding? Christian gives us 9 steps in backsliding. And if you look at those, you look at those 9 steps, he numbers them, so they're easy to follow. Step number 1, they draw off their thoughts, all that they may, from the remembrance of God, death and judgment to come. Then they cast off by degrees private duties. Then they shun the company of lively and warm Christians. And they grow cold to public duties. Number 4. Number 5, they begin to pick holes, as they say, in the coats of some of the godly. Number 6, they begin to adhere to and associate themselves with carnal, loose, and wanton men. Number 7, they give way to carnal and wanton discourses in secret. Number 8, after this they begin to play with little sins openly. And number 9, and then being hardened, they show themselves as they are. If you look at those steps, that is what happens. You start moving away from God, and then eventually doing things that are wrong in secret, and then it's open. And you look at those things. And so to recognize backsliding is like, I think he's pretty much on track. And all of those things are in Pilgrim's Progress, and that's not a complete list. The third one is salvation lived out. Shows what it is like to live, what Christianity looks like experientially. What it is, in other words, Bunyan's teaching us what salvation looks like lived out. How do you live it out? Which is why Christian continues to carry his burden even after he's entered through the wicked gate. He has to carry that burden until he gets to the cross. Okay? And live with that until he gets there. But Bunyan doesn't just give us one person's example and one person's life. That's why he brings in people like Faithful and Hopeful. because one of the things that Christian and Faithful discuss as they walk along, as they're traveling, is what it was like at this place. Oh, well, I passed that one. That wasn't any problem for me. What about the lions? Oh, they were asleep when I went through there. Because not everyone's Christian experience is exactly the same. And so he shows different experiences, different ways of dealing with life. He shows different temptations along the way. Not everyone deals with the same temptations. They are different. And so you're not reading through Pilgrim's Progress and getting one person's experience and saying, oh, well, maybe I'm not a Christian because I never experienced that. He shows that there are different experiences in life. Not everyone is exactly the same. Not everyone's experience is exactly the same. And we don't impose one person's experiences on all Christians. There are different experiences. Some places, well, the Valley of the Shadow, for instance, Christian's experience was that it was dark and it was difficult, partly because he had gone to sleep in the arbor before that and lost his role and had to go back and get it. So his experience is that it was dark and it was difficult. And Faithful says, I had sunshine all the rest of the way, through that, and also through the Valley of the Shadow of Death. That valley wasn't a big problem. I just went right through it. Different experiences. Teaches us the valuable truth of the form and freedom in a Christian life. He also shows us, Bunyan also shows us, the difference between true Christians and false Christians. Maybe I should add that Christians in quotation marks, because is there a false Christian? But somebody who claims to be a Christian and is not. In a very heart-searching way, Bunyan shows the difference between a true Christian who struggles and fights against sin and one who professes Christianity but doesn't have the transformation. Remember the two who crawled over the wall to get into the world were in the way. So what's the problem? And Christian said, but you didn't come by the cross. You didn't come by the cross. And they said, well, we're in the way. We're going the same way you are. Looking for the celestial city. And Christian recognizes that that's not right. It's not the way it is. There are positive examples. Evangelist, who always points Christian to the wicked gate, even when he strays away from it, he points him back. Faithful, who ends up being martyred in Vanity Fair. The four virtuous women at the House Beautiful: discretion, prudence, piety, charity. Those are positive examples. Some of the negative examples: Obstinate, who starts on, remember, Pliable and Obstinate start on journey with him, but they don't get very far and turn around, go back. Pliable's planning to go along with him, but then as soon as it gets difficult, he turns around and heads back. He's offended by the first subtle despond, the first thing that comes along. Talkative, a man who loves to talk about religious things, but it's all talk. He doesn't want, and Christian says something about that, that he doesn't want it to affect his life. He doesn't want it to change him. He talketh the prayer of repentance, of faith, and of the new birth, but only to talk of them. He knows only to talk of them. I have been in his family and have observed him both at home and abroad, and I know what I say of him is the truth. His house is as empty of religion as the white of an egg is of savor. Not much flavor in the white of an egg. And he says his religion is as empty as that. It's as tasteless as the white of an egg. Doesn't. And he leaves. Christian then tells Hill's Faithful. Is that right? Yeah. Christian tells Faithful that he leaves them because he doesn't want Christianity to change him. And so he walks away from them because Christian keeps bringing him back to it. It has to have an effect on your life. It has to change your life. And Talkative just wants to talk about it. He doesn't want to do anything about it. We can also learn of Demas, who lived in a delicate plane called Ease and called for people to leave the path for a little hill called Lucre, where the silver mine is. Ignorance, who believes that he has a well-grounded hope because his heart tells him so. Do we hear people like that today? Does it have relevance to today? We have people who want to talk about religion, but they don't want it to change life. Ignorance, who says he has a well-grounded hope because his heart tells him so. Not because he really has the experience from the cross, but I feel good about this. My heart tells me so. When confronted with the fact that there is none righteous, no, not one, when Christian confronts him with there is none righteous, no, not one, he says, I would never believe that my heart is thus bad. So we see this distinction between genuine Christians and hypocrites, and we see that in our world today, a blurring between genuine Christians and people who profess Christianity. If someone has accepted Jesus, he's considered a Christian, whether there are changes in his life or not. And Christian would say, there has to be a change. There has to be a change. Let's move on to the second part of the... is there any reasons, I want to add this, any other reasons that you think of for teaching Pilgrim's Progress? What you were expecting me to say and I didn't, it needs to be said.
If I would teach it largely from the spiritual value it brings out, and that the good platforms it builds to teach Christianity in our world today to our students, or how it should look.
There's relevance to today too. I think you mentioned relevance, but. What are some things that we face today? Mm-hmm. What are some lions along our path? Mm-hmm. What are some detours that we might be tempted to take? Mm-hmm. And to have the class discussion on that.
Mm-hmm. Because if it is relevant today as it was years ago, 300-plus years ago, we have to kind of modernize some things and say, okay, so that's what he dealt with there, but how is that similar to something in today's world? How is it similar to something in today's world? It is relevant. The principles are relevant. The principles are relevant. And all the scripture that he uses, that scripture has not changed. So it is relevant. But we may need to look at how is it relevant to today. Let's move on to the second part, which is the how to teach Pilgrim's Progress. And I only have six. There are many more, but I only put six on here because I'm hoping that you add some more to that. the first one is probably the easiest, but the least preferable, most likely. And that is using worksheets and quizzes. That's the easiest thing to do. You can get worksheets that are printed, and I think on my resources I have some from Christian Light that is on parts one and two. That's the easiest thing to do, is to have some worksheets, give them some quizzes, let them read it. And juniors and seniors can read it. They'll get a lot out of it. And then just discuss some things in class. It's not going to engage them as much as some of the others. It may work with some students, because there are some students who are going to read it and say, wow, that's just like today. But 90% of your students are going to say, I don't know what he means. This is boring. And you have to have something else that's going to engage them, something that's going to draw them into it. And after they're drawn into it, they'll get it. But just handing them the book and a couple of worksheets is not going to draw them into it. But it is one of the possibilities, and it's the easiest one. And it's kind of the default for most of us. Second one is something that I've done a few times, and it depends on the class. It depends. You know, when my students come in ninth grade, I know that I have them for English for the next 4 years. Okay? And so I learn to know some of my students. I learn to know what some of their interests are, some of their abilities outside of English class. And so sometimes I may give some students this number two as an option for something for you to do, and that is to illustrate it. You can have students individually illustrate a particular scene. You can have a group of students working together, as long as there's one person who can draw stick figures. Now, and I don't require anything more than stick figures when I do an illustration. I don't expect artist production, okay? If there is someone who really likes to draw and does a better job, it's great. But illustrate, the main point is that they get the scene illustrated. They get that particular scene illustrated. And I usually have one group or one person, depends on the class, one group or one person do one scene and the next group do another scene, and we kind of, you know, pick out some scenes all the way through Pilgrim's Progress and have them illustrate different scenes along the way. And then we can post them, and here's a little bit of Pilgrim's Progress. And you can see. And what happens is my other classes come into my room and they see these pictures up there and they're like, what's that? Well, that's Pilgrim's Progress. And some of them are familiar enough with it. They've read Little Pilgrim's Progress or, you know, whatever else. And they're familiar enough with the story that they can pick out, oh, yeah, I know what that is. I know what's happening there. At least if the drawings are, you know, good enough that they can tell what it's supposed to be. And I tell them, I do not grade you on artistic ability. I grade you on showing what's happening in the scene. That you have the details, some of the details of the scene, but not necessarily. You may need to interpret it for them. That's fine. As long as it's there. So that's the second one. Either having them work individually or having them work in groups. As long as there's one person in the group who can draw and the other two people, or however many you have in the group, telling them what to draw and helping them figure out what to put on the picture. It does take some class time for them to do that. It does take some of the class time to do that. A third one is to write a letter. You can have them write two letters from Christian to his wife, Christiane, one near the beginning of the journey and one near the end of the journey, telling her about his journey about what's happening. You can also have a letter from Christiana to Christian if you use part two. What would she want to tell him? Or any other combination that you think would work. A letter may be a good way for the student to identify and express some of the feelings that are going on. Maybe Christian to any of the other characters in the story. Maybe after Christian has gone on, there's somebody that he met back here somewhere who starts thinking about what Christian said and says, you know, I think he was right. And they change. And they want to write to him. So you can get them. It's their creativity at that point, because it's not based on the book necessarily, but it is based on what did happen in the book and taking it to the next step. What would happen? What else would they say besides what's actually in the text in the book? So, third one is writing a letter. Fourth one, in our day with lots of media around us, sometimes students are fascinated by this one, be a journalist and you're following Christian's journey. And you're giving newscasts, news report, news articles on, well, now he's here. Okay. And so we take something like the Tour de France, and every day there's a new, you know, well, this is what happened today, and this is the leader today, and then the next day, oh, they raced in this part, and you know, here's what happened, the times and all of that. So have them follow Christian as he goes through his journey and give a little report. And you can have one person doing it, or you can have them, one person does one day, one thing that happens, and then you go to another day and there's somebody else who is the journalist that day and you're, you know, reporting a news report on what happens. Just like there might be a daily article in the newspaper about Christian's journey. And you can use modern language, modernize it, put it into today's language of what's happening as he goes through this journey. And that leads me into the next one, which is modernizing the story. And we talked about just making it relevant for today. What are some of the things that we deal with? What are the temptations that we deal with? What are the struggles that we have? What are the lions of today? Vanity Fair was a town that there were people there who had been there, that had been on the journey that Christian was on, and they got to Vanity Fair and they just stayed there. Never continued the journey. So what are the places along the way? We start our Christian life and we get to a certain point and we just kind of put our roots down there, stay there. And we never get to where we're supposed to be. What are those things that would tempt us to just stay where we are? Modernizing it. Choose an encounter and rewrite that particular encounter using a modern day perspective. And while I'm on that, basically what they're doing is writing a parody. Which a parody is just a rewriting of something that has been written before, modernizing it or changing it. But the structure of the story is there, the details of the story are there, they're just changing them a little bit. And students find it pretty easy to write parodies because the structure is there. The structure is there for them to use. They don't have to come up with everything on their own. Christian meets, you know, whoever it is. So, who would that be today? Who would that person be today? And puts them in a modern setting. Sixth one that I have is to read the story together in class and have each one of the characters in the story taken by one of the people, kind of like a reader's theater kind of thing with Christian, somebody representing Christian and somebody faithful and whoever else comes in the story. You need to have a narrator. Most sections of the book, you need to have a narrator that does the rest of the sections. But you can read some of it that way. I wouldn't do the whole thing that way. But a particular section, you can pick out a section that has a lot of conversation going back and forth. It's a good section to do that way. I did a lot of that the 1 year that I had a student in the class who was dyslexic, struggled to read, but if he sat there listening, he got it. And sometimes I wondered in class if he was actually getting it, because we would be reading it in class and he'd be looking at the ceiling, looking all around the room. But when we started discussing it, he knew the details. He got it. And if I expected him to read it on his own in class, I mean outside of class, he would have gotten it. He would not have gotten the story. So it depends on who's in the class. I don't usually do it. I often, oh, today we're going to read a couple pages, you know. I'll do that. But I don't do a lot of reading it in class. Expect the juniors and seniors to read most of it outside of class. But once in a while, we'll read a little bit in class. They enjoy it. They like taking parts and reading it. The last one that I have, and I said there were six, the last one that I have is just vary the activity. Don't always do the same thing. It might take you a couple of weeks to get through Pilgrim's Progress. And if you do the same thing every day, you're going to lose them. You're going to lose them. They just won't be there. And they're not going to stay engaged in it. But switching it up, changing things, giving them something, a different pace, is a good thing. So, again, what are some things that you would like to try or that you've done?
What did you say? It might take a couple of weeks to get through it?
I spend a couple of weeks till we get through it.
Okay, maybe I'm not... if we're going to do it as a half-credit elective, just do like a half hour per day, just over like that way. We were going to go with the worksheet and quizzes, but what we did last year is last year we went through Christian ethics together, and we did it together as a class, most of that. At least read it together, have discussion on it before we do any work. Like, forget about the worksheet, that is second priority. We read the story together aloud, because I have one of the same students on dyslexia, like he doesn't read well, but he catches everything that we read aloud. Therefore, it's a benefit for us to do it together as a class, so we do it together, and then after the story is read or even throughout, we'll stop and we'll talk about it. We'll put ourselves in there and we'll challenge each other, like, where are we at? What are we doing? What are we seeing? Let's not just read it as this was back then. No, this is today. And then at the end of that, we will do the work as much as we get done and the quizzes, whatever. But that was second priority. I found that to be working pretty good last year for the stuff we did then. So I was hoping to do the same thing with the Prague Pilgrim Forest.
I could spend a lot more time on it than what I do. Yeah. Because it's part of my British literature class, I give a couple of weeks for this, but I'm trying to work it into all of British literature from Beowulf to late 1900s. Mm-hmm. You know? And so I'm trying to fit it into the concept of the whole thing, but I could, you could easily spend a lot more time on it than I do.
It's because what we do is like, you guys all know how electives work, or like credits work and all that. So we, as a school, we choose a half-credit elective for the students. And this year, it is this one that we chose. Therefore, we tend to make it, it's supposed to be 60 hours. Mm-hmm. So that's quite a bit of hours. But we can drag it in there. If you use discussions and that, you can easily use that, depending on how thorough you want to be here.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking forward to that. I really appreciated the insight you gave on that. Helps me out.
Students, if you would drag this out too long, drag out the story. I mean, like, would you say maybe half a year?
Depends how you do it. If you get them into it and they're good at discussing things, you get them into doing that, you could probably give you a half a year.
You take this class here, the leading productive classroom discussions, and then this could work. I think it'll be a good topic to be on. Because this, what we face today is exactly these problems.
It is very relevant for today. And as a student, a high school student reading it, some students will see the relevance, but most of them will not. Most of them, you need to start helping them to see it. And after they get started, there are a couple of stages. I have some students who they'll read it and, oh, this is really neat. You know, this is just like today. And then I have students who I start talking about things and we start discussing things and some of the other students start saying things and I'm like, how do you see that? They don't see it at all. But after we get to discussing a little bit more, they start picking up on it and they start seeing some things too.
Half of my class has gone through Literature 1 now from Christian Lights, and they use a lot of stories in there from this book, so they already somewhat have the concept. Yeah, so that part would be nice.
I'm not a high school teacher or anything, but grade 5 and 6 teacher. I wonder, have you ever done anything like a culminating, or brought it to a culminating production, like a portfolio kind of thing that they track, you know, all through the book and put it together in some form?
I haven't had them actually put anything together. I've done some things with, like I said, with a journalist who do these news reports on them, but never actually put the whole thing together. That's a good idea.
But you do intersperse some of the worksheets and quizzes, maybe, but then throw in other activities, yes.
You mentioned about parity. What's your evaluation as far as the Celestial Railroad?
Oh, Celestial Railroad, which is a parody of Public Progress. I like Celestial Railroad because it does show the spiritual climate of the day that Hawthorne is living in, and the transcendentalists and the, but you almost need to, for students to understand how, you can look at the two and say, yes, Celestial Railroad is a parody of Pilgrim Progress, because again, it's a dream literature. It starts out with a dream and then he wakes up. And he has some of the same characters and some of the same places. And it's obviously a much shorter than Pilgrim's Progress, but a parody of it. But students almost need to have some background on transcendentalism and the philosophy, the religious ideas that were included that are really what Hawthorne is kind of. A parody is often used to make fun of something. And I say, he is not making fun of Pilgrim's Progress. He is using the form of Pilgrim's Progress to point out the error of the transcendentalists. But they almost have to have some background on transcendentalism before it makes any sense for them. They can see the parallels, but for it to make any sense of why it's so significant that instead of burdens on their backs, all the baggage goes in the baggage car and is pulled along with them in the train. They don't get rid of it. Well, when you know the religious ideas of Hawthorne's day, it's the bridge, the foundation for the bridge that the train goes over, has all sorts of things. Eastern religion, books of Eastern religion, philosophy of Immanuel Kant was mentioned. I forget who else that he specifically mentions. And that's what the bridge is built on, but never on actual scripture. Modern commentaries on scripture. Which I do use Celestial Railroad in a different class, not the same one that we do, but couldn't use it in the British literature. because Auburn did not lose. Any other comments? Put one last screen up here. It's just a thank you for participating. And one of the things that with the committee, and I'm trying to deal with what they wanted me to talk about, a piece of literature. And so what piece of literature should we talk about? What should I do? Oh, my stuff is on. I finally came down to Pilgrim's Progress. But if you have something that you would like to hear something on, let either somebody on the committee put it on your evaluation paper, a suggestion. Or let me know. Because we do look for suggestions and for ideas. They said they wanted one on literature, one on grammar, and one on writing. But to come down to specifically what that was going to be, it took a little bit of time to finalize it. So, thank you.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.